I'm just so impressed and happy to be here to be introducing Derek. Just his combination of intellect and passion. Usually it seems you get one or the other. You get somebody who can really think things out all meticulously, but then they come up with a dry husk. But not so with Derek. His work is deeply worked, deeply felt, and extremely well written. He's a smart man. He's a sensitive man. He lives with nature. He tries his best to live his own principles. So please, Derek Jensen.
I flew in last night from San Diego, where I did a talk, and of course, being in Southern California always makes me really sad, because there's so many people, and then I flew up, and there's still too many people here. I don't mean here. And then I was walking through the Portland airport last night, and I don't know, those of you who've been in the airport, I don't know if this disturbs you as much as it did me, but I was very disturbed by the stone map of the Columbia, because it just seems really ironic at best and blasphemous, really, to be making markers to this river that's being systematically murdered. And there was a post that I saw as I was walking out that was about salmon, and I was really disturbed by the fact that they would put up this post to salmon once again as they're being systematically eliminated. There's a problem there, and I'm never sure what to talk about these days, because you know, I've been doing the Endgame talk for several years, and if YouTube didn't exist, then I could go ahead and do it, and nobody would ever know it other than that, and it'd be like, oh my gosh, it was really exciting. Did this cool thing about Star Wars. And I keep doing the talk for a couple reasons. One of them is that I can't think of anything more important to talk about than the fact that this culture is killing the planet and we need to stop it using any means necessary. I mean, I would love to talk about where art comes from, or the relationship between dreaming and waking reality and our relationships with the muse. You know, the muse is a real being, and I would love to talk about that, but 120 species went extinct today, and they were my brothers and sisters, and so I can't think of anything more important to talk about than bringing down civilization. And I did the talk in San Diego Thursday night, and so at one point I said industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable, and I saw this man in the third or fourth row, who I later learned is a longtime activist, sort of, when I said industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable, he looked at me really quizzically and sort of, and it was clear to me that he'd never thought about that before, and he's been an activist for a long time. And the propaganda for this culture is so deep and so ubiquitous that, you know, it's like there's a lot of ground that has to be covered. And I mean, there's a part of me that wants to talk about who the muse is, or who my muse is, and our relationship with the other sides. And then there's also a part of me that wants to talk about, okay, how do we form paramilitary organizations to systematically take out the oil infrastructure? How do we put our lives, how do we put our bodies between the oil infrastructure and the planet? How do we organize? How do we technically go about doing what MEND is doing in Nigeria, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta? They have said to members of the oil industry, it should be clear that the government cannot protect you, so leave our land or die in it. And they've been able to reduce the output of the oil industry in Nigeria by 20%. And if we had 1% of their courage and love for the land where they live, we could do the same here. But there's a lot of basic ground that has to be covered before there. I got two emails after the talk in San Diego that sort of showed the different responses. One person wrote and said that he had brought his girlfriend to the talk, and they had never talked before about my work because he was always afraid that it would break up their relationship. And he was really happy that when they went back afterwards, that she didn't fight him about civilization. They'd never really talked about it, and she didn't fight him about that. And she said, "I want to do whatever is necessary." And he said, "It's already just, you know, one day later made their relationship better." So maybe that should be like a first date question or something, you know? And then on the other hand, there was a guy who emailed me later about how really I was all wrong because wind energy will save the day for industrial humans, presumably, and how it's not true that civilization is inherently destructive. And so once again, I come back to, you know, going back to that talk, and then also another thing that I've done is I've done Q&As where I've skipped the talk, and that's what I was sort of thinking about doing tonight until I was given orders from on high to do the endgame talk. But the hesitation I have on doing that is a lot of times when I've gone straight to Q&A, once again, there's a lot of basic deconstruction of this culture that hasn't been done, and so a lot of the questions are, well, if we just take shorter showers, isn't that good enough? You know, and if we just can't we just compost our way out of the problems we're in? And so what I would like to do is why don't we actually, since we live in a democracy, which is my best joke of the night, why don't we go ahead and take a vote? And how many people would want me to do the endgame talk? We'll go the same amount of time no matter what we do, but the choices are endgame talk or go straight to Q&A. How many people want endgame talk first? Okay, how many people want Q&A? Okay, those of you who want Q&A, do you have money you can give me? And actually, what I should have done is just take the vote and then ignore you and do whatever the hell I want to do anyway. I would like to thank Portland State University, Boo? Okay, Boo. I thought you hated Portland State University or something. Kate, Megan, Robin, Dan, Sally, Helen, and Brian, Bob. The other, I thought it said utter volunteers. And the utterly supreme volunteers. And I would also like to thank all of the activists in the room just for your work. It's all important. So, endgame it is. I don't know if you know this, but the first draft of the movie Star Wars was not actually written by George Lucas and company. The first draft of the movie Star Wars was written by environmentalists, and it was quite a bit different than the final draft ended up being. Is there anybody here who does not know the plot of the movie Star Wars? It's always the same. There's like, you know, two people, and they're really embarrassed. So the plot of the movie Star Wars is, well, it came out in 1977, which was the perfect time for me to see it. I was a junior in high school, and I went to see it, and I went back and told all my friends, "Oh my God, this movie is so amazing, it's incredible, and the acting is so good." So all my friends went to see it, and they all loved it, and we weren't those sorts of nerds who saw it 1,000 times or anything. I mean, for one thing, we weren't nerds. And for another thing, we were way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. So the plot of the movie is that the Empire has built this giant machine called the Death Star. And it's a machine that's capable of destroying entire planets. And that's, of course, a wonderful metaphor for the dominant culture, which is a machine that is killing the planet. And in the movie, the rebels find a way to blow up the Death Star, and then Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters and drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port and blow up the Death Star. and that's I pretty much ruined the movie. It's still worth seeing for the acting. And anyway, so the environmentalist version was a little bit different. For one thing, it was not called Star Wars. It was called Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. And for another, they didn't actually blow up the Death Star. Instead, they used other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover that there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will also thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors. And they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. Scribbled in the margin is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it's imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous. But they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Other plans include sending petitions and filing lawsuits. Now, we all know that would be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on the planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star, and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. Stirring debates are held on screen among these rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach to the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. Once inside the Death Star, there's a splinter group breaks off from those about to lock themselves down. They rush down hallways, they avoid all the troopers, and they burn a couple transporters, and they use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And then there's another group that breaks off from that, and they sneak down other hallways, and they get past even more troopers. They make it all the way to Darth Vader's secret headquarters, and then they hit him with a vegan cream pie. Near the end of the movie, there's another debate that's held among the rebels, and that's actually a problem I had with the environmentalist screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must above all else have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he too was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. He didn't mention whether those tears would be of frustration. So finally, Leto, Khan, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up and then tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And everybody else is just horrified. I mean, you cannot do that. And so in the exciting final scene of the environmentalist version, there's a scuffle that breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, and Chewbacca on one side and the pacifists on the other. And then the pacifists are able to chase those four from the room and then from the film. And they're never seen again, which isn't really important because they're minor characters anyway. Anyway, so what happens in the environmentalist version is that the Death Star gets closer and closer. And then you see the planet, and you see the Death Star. You see the planet, you see the Death Star, you see the laser start to glow this hellish red. You see the planet again, and then psss, There's a little spark. And what that is, that's the environmentalists getting away before the planet blows up. And then viewers are just waiting on the edges of their seats to see if the letters and petitions and lawsuits work their magic. But then what happens is that the planet gets blown up. And then the final shot of the movie, which shows what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times that devotes a full 3 sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press. That's the end of the story. So I was doing a talk in Asheville, North Carolina a few years ago. And after the talk, during the Q&A, this one guy raised his hand. So he said, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, I don't know, I'll bite. How many? And he said, it wasn't a riddle. This is not how it's supposed to work. And then later that night, I went back to my hotel, and I was really fixating on that question, which says a lot more about my social life than I wanted to. And I came up with an answer of how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb, and the answer is 10. 1 to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change, 4 to circulate online petitions, 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change, 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way real change occurs, 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself, 1 to write a bunch of books about how and why the light bulb needs to change, and finally 1 to smash the light bulb because we all know it's never going to change. Now, it's really great to do that joke in front of an audience that gets it. You know, I mean, it's like, not to, I don't have to say, light bulb culture, get it? It's not worth it, the joke's not that good. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they capsized, so large that horses were afraid to get in the water, so large you couldn't see the bottom of the river, so large that you could hear these runs from miles before you would see them? After a talk I did one time, somebody came up and gave me a photograph, and it was a picture of a river in Alaska, and I was like, so great, why'd you give me a picture of this? And I looked at it more closely, and the bottom of the river was brown, but then I realized that the bottom of the river is not actually brown because at the edges you can see yellow. What this is the river is full of fish. You cannot see the bottom of the river. The entire river is full of fish. And I showed that to my mom, and my mom said, yeah, give it about another 10 or 15 years, and it'll be gone, so we need to bring this civilization down now. And so what will it take? Will it take death of runs of salmon so large that they would feed entire peoples? Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons that were so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, flying 60 miles an hour and sounding like rolling thunder. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews that were so large that if you turn your head away and shoot a gun, you'd kill 15, 16, 17 of these birds. And they were so fat that when they hit the ground, they would explode. And maybe to take the death of great auks. Does anybody know why there aren't any penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? There were penguins. They were called great auks. And there were so many that one French explorer said that you could load every ship in France and it wouldn't make a dent. And they did load every ship in France and it did make a dent. And the last great auk was killed in the 19th century. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. Maybe it'll take... Oh, this is pretty interesting. I was doing a talk here in Portland, and afterwards this guy came up to me and said, you know, I don't think it's time to fight back yet. And I said, okay, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. Give me a threshold. 91%, 92%, 93%, 94%. He never stopped me. And maybe it'll take, did I already mention docs and every mother's breast milk? Maybe it'll take global warming. Maybe it'll take the hole in the ozone. You know, what will it take for you to finally call it an apocalypse? You know, those of you who've read my books know that I write in almost every book about how much I listen, how much I love listening to the frogs who live in a pond near my house. And in almost every book, I write that I fear that this may be the year that the worldwide amphibian die-off comes home. And that was last spring. 2 years ago, you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night. This spring, I could only hear 5 or 6 frogs at a time. This was the year. And what will it take? One of the questions I ask all the time is, why is it that we, as environmentalists, we as human beings, why are we so often losing? And I have a few answers to that. One of them, I think, is that, I mean, because we're losing badly on every front. Rates of deforestation are still through the roof. You know, global warming is terrifying. Oh, sorry, cap and trade's going to solve it. And so what, why is it that we always lose? And I think there's a couple answers I have. One of them is, I'm not sure that a lot of us really know what we want. And I don't think a lot of us really think strategically. And we don't ask, what is it that we want? And so, you know, do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, gentler clear cuts? You know, we want the mariners to actually do something once in a while. You know, what is it that we want out of life? And that's unfortunate because the other side knows what they want. And what they want is every last tree and every last fish. And they want them now. And they'll do whatever it takes to get there. And I don't know about you, but for myself at least, I've been able to answer that question of what I want. I'm very clear on this. What I want is I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more amphibians every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world with more large fish in the oceans every year and less dioxin in every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And I will do whatever it takes to get there. There's another reason that we so often lose, which is that there's this great book by Robert J. Lifton. It's called The Nazi Doctors. And in this book, he asks the question, how is it that people, men, who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go and work in Nazi death camps? And what he found is that many of the doctors actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates. And they would do everything they could to help the inmates. Everything except for one thing, which we'll talk about in a moment. They would give them an aspirin to lick if they were in pain. They would put them to bed. They would hide them from selection officers. They would feed them an extra scrap of potato. They would do everything they could except for question the existence of the death camp itself. And so often, I see environmentalists, and I include myself in this as a longtime grassroots activist, what I see us do is I see so many of us doing everything we can to protect this or that place that we love, or to protect this or that creature we love, this or that plant we love. We do everything we can except for the most important thing of all, which is to question the existence of the larger death camp culture that's killing the planet. This culture that's turning the whole planet into first a work camp and then a death camp. And so we do what pathetically little is left to us within those confines. And I'm saying pathetic not as an attack on environmentalists, of which I am myself one, but instead to acknowledge that given what is happening, our efforts are insufficient. Okay, so those are some of the reasons I think we lose. And the next question that I always ask is, do you believe that the culture will have a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? I ask this question all over, and nobody ever says yes. Actually, one guy did in San Diego, and he's the second person out of thousands of people at talks who said yes, they believe the culture is going to have a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. A lot of times people laugh. It's a silly question. And The next question is, if you don't believe the culture is going to have a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean? And you care about life on this earth. What does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And that's one of my favorite things to do, is to bash hope. And I'll do some of that later on. So the rest of the formal talk here is going to be structured about talking about the premises of the book Endgame. And what I do in that book, which is, I think, kind of interesting, is I lay out my premises before the book starts. And one of the reasons I do that is because one of the first rules of propaganda is, if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. And I don't want to do that. We see this all the time. Hitler was great at this. It was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So, for example, Hitler would say, what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? Gosh, Adolf, good question. What are we going to do about it? And then you can start technically trying to figure out what you're going to do about it. But the thing, did you notice what he just did? He slid by you the premise that there's a Jewish problem you've got to do something about. But of course, that was, 70 years ago? And I guess, 70 years ago. So, of course, people don't do that anymore. But think about it. So let's say you hear some talking head on television saying, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Gosh, good question. Am I the only person here, by the way, who, like, every time the stock market goes down 300 points, like, yes! So how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Okay, first premise, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Second premise, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Third premise, who the hell's we? And so I don't want to do that, and so I want to go through the premises, some of them at least, one by one, so you can accept or reject them explicitly. First premise, industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. And this is true for all of civilization, but especially industrial civilization. And several years ago, I was riding in the car with a friend of mine, George Straffen, and I was just making conversation. And I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George was not in a very good mood that day. And he said, that's a really stupid question, Derek. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be living there again someday, and the only question really is what will be left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, I would say it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. If you have a finite amount of... It doesn't matter what. I mean, if you have a finite amount of something, if you're anybody but an economist, you understand that if you're using it, you'll use it up. And so you would think that if you have an entire economy that's based on the use of, I don't know, let's choose a random example, oil, that you would ask yourself what you're going to do when this oil runs out. Same with, you know, whatever else, copper. I mean, people say sometimes, so what would it take to get the people in the non-industrialized nations living at the same standard of living as the United States? Well, it would take about 10 more planets, for one thing. It would take a lot more copper than the planet has, a lot more aluminum, a lot more zinc. Ain't gonna happen. And anyway, so if you have a finite amount, you cannot base a way of living. If you want it to be sustainable, you cannot base a way of living on non-renewable resources. I would take it a step further, and I would say that any way of living that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. So if every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, eventually there will be none. And anybody who is not head of the National Marine Fisheries Services will understand this. The same is true with passenger pigeons. The same is true with Eskimo curlews. The same, it doesn't matter. If every year there are fewer returned than the year before, if every year there is less of this being, you run out. And, you know, this really goes to the heart of a lot of how many of us perceive existence itself, in that we've been told that evolution is based on competition. It's based on survival of the fittest. It's based on survival of the meanest. It's based on those who can exploit the best. I mean, I hate watching those nature programs where they talk about these, you know, mean bears who conquer each other's territory. It's just the propaganda that basically is a projection of the capitalist conqueror mindset onto the natural world is really extraordinary. And to show how stupid it is that to believe that all of evolution is based on competition, I can disprove it in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons. And that is, those creatures who survived in the long run have survived in the long run. Semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. Semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. This is what salmon do. Salmon actually make the world. How do you think the world got to be so amazingly fecund and diverse and strong and beautiful in the first place? It's by everybody living and dying and by making the world a better place by their very existence. And salmon make forests stronger. Forests make salmon stronger. That's how we live. It's not survival of the fittest. Dolores LaChapelle taught me that it's survival of the fit, which is how well you fit into your surroundings, how well you fit into your habitat. That's how you survive. And I mean, even Richard Dawkins, you know, even he says that there are two stable states for evolution. One would be based on pure competition, one would be based on pure cooperation. And he says that the reason that pure cooperation won't work is because if you have a cheater, everything falls apart. It's like, we got a cheater, and everything's kind of falling apart. Think about it. Anyway, so I'm going to take it a step further, and it's not just any way of life that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last, but instead, I would say that any way of life that's based on the use of resources won't last. Because, and the reason I say that is because resources don't exist. Trees don't consider themselves a timber resource, and salmon don't consider themselves a fisheries resource. They're just trees, they're just fish. And this is really important because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And if you perceive others as resources, you will use them because resources are there to be used. If you perceive others as being, well, think about it this way. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. Same is true of salmon. If when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And just because when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, doesn't mean I can't eat it. I was doing a radio interview in Spokane, Washington several years ago, and the radio interviewer said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And I knew that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. And that afternoon, I went out and I asked a tree with whom I had a long relationship, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you do not take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. If I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. And everybody knows this. I mean, bears know it, mergansers know it. Mergansers know that if they eat all the newts in a pond, they're not going to have anything to eat. Everybody knows this, except we forget. And I got in this big argument with this guy a few years ago because he said, you know, you use toilet paper too, and because you use toilet paper, that means you're just as culpable for deforestation as a CEO of Weyerhaeuser. And my response was extraordinarily, was brilliant, frankly. It was, no, I'm not. And so, and he said, well, go ask a tree. And so I did. I went and asked a tree. And the tree said a couple things. First off, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. And second, it said, yes, you are culpable, but not because you use toilet paper. You're culpable because you consume the flesh of trees, but you don't take responsibility for the continuation of their community by stopping Weyerhaeuser. You're culpable for something much, much deeper than consuming. You're responsible because you don't stop the other. It's like, okay, I did this interview maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago in which I was talking about how lifestyle changes are not sufficient and how, you know, stopping driving myself or not taking, you know, not taking showers is not going to save the Columbia River, you know? And I was saying this, and one of the examples I used of this is that you have to be more proactive. Is I said, okay, there's 10 men in a room and there's one woman, and one man starts to rape that woman. Is it sufficient for you to step back and say, I'm not going to participate? That's essentially a lifestyle change, you know? I refuse to participate, and that's going to stop it. And it seems pretty obvious to me. It's a straightforward... So I get an email a couple days later from this guy saying that he disagrees, and that if that situation occurred, that one man then not participating would reduce the amount of rape by 1/10. He was a moron. Now he's going to listen to this, and he's going to come after me when he hears on KBOO. No, he won't, actually. He will not participate. Okay, so that's all nice, Derek, that, you know, all this stuff about resources and everything. But what does it have to do with civilization? And remember, industrial civilization is not, can ever be sustainable, and any civilization is not, can ever be sustainable. So let's find, you know, I've been bashing civilization for a number of years, and I thought with Endgame I'd probably better define it. And civilization I define as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? And a city I've defined as people, I'm sorry, yes, a city I've defined as people living in numbers large enough that they require the importation of resources. And what this means is the Talua, on whose land I now live, were not living in cities, and they were not civilized. They lived in villages, camps. They did not require the importation of resources. They would eat salmon and huckleberry and marine mammals and smelt and lamprey and salmon and salmon and salmon. And then usually in the winter they would eat a lot of salmon. And they lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talua, they lived there since the beginning of time. Well, when I was doing a talk at Princeton a few years ago, and I said that the Talua lived there for 12,500 years, and that was, so far as I was concerned, sustainable. And this one guy in the audience shouted out, no, the fact that they lived there for 12,500 years does not mean they were living sustainably. I said, okay. And then I said, why? And he said, well, because we don't have a quantitative analysis showing that there were the same number of salmon 12,500 years ago as there were 12,400 years later when the dominant culture arrived. And I said, you're a science major, aren't you? Oh, that one did not go over very well.